Chapter 5 Herb and Vera Smith went back to Pownall and took up the embroidery of their days. Herb finished a house in Durham that December. Their savings did indeed melt away, as Sarah had foreseen, and they applied to the state for extraordinary disaster assistance. That aged Herb almost as much as the accident itself had done. EDA was only a fancy way of saying welfare or charity in his mind. He had spent a lifetime working hard and honestly with his hands, and had thought he would never see the day when he would have to take a state dollar. But here that day was. Vera subscribed to three new magazines, which came through the mail at irregular intervals. All three were badly printed, and might have been illustrated by talented children. God's Saucers, The Coming Transfiguration, and God's Psychic Miracles. The upper room, which still came monthly, now sometimes lay unopened for as long as 3 weeks at a stretch, but she read these others to tatters. She found a great many things in them that seemed to bear upon Johnny's accident, and she read these nuggets to her tired husband at supper in a high, piercing voice that trembled with exultation. Herb found himself telling her more and more frequently to be quiet, and on occasion shouting at her to shut up that drivel and let him alone. When he did that, she would give him long-suffering, compassionate, and hurt glances, then slink upstairs to continue her studies. She began to correspond with these magazines, and to exchange letters with the contributors and with other pen friends who had had similar experiences in their lives. Most of her correspondents were good-hearted people like Vera herself, people who wanted to help and to ease the nearly insupportable burden of her pain. They sent prayers and prayer stones, they sent charms, they sent promises to include Johnny in their nightly devotions. Yet there were others who were nothing but con men and women, and Herb was alarmed by his wife's increasing inability to recognize these. There was an offer to send her a sliver of the one true cross of our Lord for just $99.98, an offer to send a vial of water drawn from the spring at Lourdes, which would almost certainly work a miracle when rubbed into Johnny's forehead. That one was $110 plus postage. Cheaper, and more attractive to Vera, was a continuously playing cassette tape of the 23rd Psalm and the Lord's Prayer, as spoken by Southern evangelist Billy Humbar. Played at Johnny's bedside over a period of weeks, it would almost certainly effect a marvelous recovery, according to the pamphlet. As an added blessing, for a short time only, an autographed picture of Billy Humbar himself would be included. Herb was forced to step in more and more frequently as her passion for these pseudo-religious gewgaws grew. Sometimes he surreptitiously tore up her checks and simply readjusted the checkbook balance upward. But when the offer specified cash and nothing but, he simply had to put his foot down. And Vera began to draw away from him, to view him with distrust as a sinner and an unbeliever. Sarah Bracknell kept school during her days. Her afternoons and evenings were not much different than they had been following the breakup with Dan. She was in a kind of limbo, waiting for something to happen. In Paris, the peace talks were stalled. Nixon had ordered the bombing of Hanoi continued, in spite of rising domestic and foreign protests. At a press conference, he produced pictures proving conclusively that American planes were surely not bombing North Vietnamese hospitals, but he went everywhere by army helicopter. The investigation into the brutal rape murder of a Castle Rock waitress was stalled following the release of a wandering sign painter who had once spent 3 years in the Augusta State Mental Hospital. Against everyone's expectations, the sign painter's alibi had turned out to hold water. Janis Joplin was screaming the blues. Paris decreed for the second year in a row that hemlines would go down, but they didn't. Sarah was aware of all these things in a vague way, like voices from another room where some incomprehensible party went on and on. The first snow fell, just a dusting, then a second dusting, and 10 days before Christmas there was a storm that closed area schools for the day, and she sat home, looking out at the snow as it filled Flag Street. Her brief thing with Johnny—she could not even properly call it an affair— was part of another season now, and she could feel him beginning to slip away from her. It was a panicky feeling, as if a part of her was drowning, drowning in days. She read a good deal about head injuries, comas, and brain damage. None of it was very encouraging. She found out there was a girl in a small Maryland town who had been in a coma for 6 years. There had been a young man from Liverpool, England, who had been struck by a grappling hook while working on the docks and had remained in a coma for 14 years before expiring. Little by little, this brawny young dock walloper had severed his connections with the world, wasting away, losing his hair, optic nerves degenerating into oatmeal behind his closed eyes, body gradually drawing up into a fetal position as his ligaments shortened. He had reversed time, had become a fetus again, swimming in the placental waters of coma as his brain degenerated. An autopsy following his death had shown that the folds and convolutions of his cerebrum had smoothed out, leaving the frontal and prefrontal lobes almost utterly smooth and blank. "Oh, Johnny, it just isn't fair," she thought, watching the snow fall outside, filling the world up with blank whiteness, burying fallen summer and a red-gold autumn. "It isn't fair. They should let you go to whatever there is to go to." There was a letter from Herb Smith every 10 days to 2 weeks. Vera had her pen friends, and he had his. He wrote in a large, sprawling hand, using an old-fashioned fountain pen. "We are both fine and well, waiting to see what will happen next, as you must be. Yes, I have been doing some reading, and I know what you are too kind and thoughtful to say in your letter, Sarah. It looks bad, but of course we hope. I don't believe in God the way Vera does, but I do believe in him after my fashion, and wonder why he didn't take John outright if he was going to. Is there a reason? No one knows, I guess. We only hope." In another letter, "I'm having to do most of the Xmas shopping this year, as Vera has decided Xmas presents are a sinful custom. This is what I mean about her getting worse all the time. She always thought it was a holy day instead of a holiday, if you see what I mean, and if she saw me calling it Xmas instead of Christmas, I guess she'd shoot me for a hoss thief. She was always saying how we should remember it is the birthday of Jesus Christ and not Santa Claus, but she never minded the shopping before. In fact, she used to like it. Now, ragging against it is all she talks about, seems like. She gets a lot of these funny ideas from the people she writes back and forth to. Golly, I do wish she'd stop and get back to normal. But otherwise, we are both fine and well. Herb." And a Christmas card that she had wept over a little. "Best to you from both of us this holiday season, and if you'd like to come down and spend Xmas with a couple of old fogies, the spare bedroom is made up. Vera and I are both fine and well. Hope the new year is better for all of us, and am sure it will be. Herb and Vera." She didn't go down to Pownall over the Christmas vacation, partly because of Vera's continued withdrawal into her own world. Her progress into that world could be read pretty accurately between the lines of Herb's letters, and partly because their mutual tie now seemed so strange and distant to her. The still figure in the Bangor hospital bed had once been seen in close-up, but now she always seemed to be looking at him through the wrong end of memory's telescope. Like the balloon man, he was far and wee, so it seemed best to keep her distance. Perhaps Herb sensed it as well. His letters became less frequent as 1970 became 1971. In one of them, he came as close as he could to saying it was time for her to go on with her life, and closed by saying that he doubted a girl as pretty as she was lacked for dates. But she hadn't had any dates, hadn't wanted them. Jean Sudeikis, the math teacher who had once treated her to an evening that had seemed at least 1,000 years long, had begun asking her out indecently soon after Johnny's accident, and he was a hard man to discourage. But she believed that he was finally beginning to get the point. It should have happened sooner. Occasionally other men would ask her, and one of them, a law student named Walter Hazlitt, attracted her quite a bit. She met him at Anne Stafford's New Year's Eve party. She had meant only to make an appearance, but she had stayed quite a while, talking primarily to Hazlitt. Saying no had been surprisingly hard, but she had, because she understood the source of attraction too well. Walt Hazlitt was a tall man with an unruly shock of brown hair and a slanted, half-cynical smile, and he reminded her strongly of Johnny. That was no basis on which to get interested in a man. Early in February, she was asked out by the mechanic who worked on her car at Cleves Mills Chevron. Again, she had almost said yes, and then backed away. The man's name was Arnie Tremont. He was tall, olive-skinned, and handsome in a smiling, predatory way. He reminded her a bit of James Brolin, the second banana on that Dr. Welby program, and even more of a certain Delta Tau Delta named Dan. Better to wait. Wait and see if something was going to happen. But nothing did. In that summer of 1971, Greg Stilson, 16 years older and wiser than the Bible salesman who had kicked a dog to death in a deserted Iowa dooryard, sat in the back room of his newly incorporated insurance and real estate business in Ridgeway, New Hampshire. He hadn't aged much in the years between. There was a net of wrinkles around his eyes now, and his hair was longer, but still quite conservative. He was still a big man, and his swivel chair creaked when he moved. He sat smoking a pell-mell cigarette and looking at the man sprawled comfortably in the chair opposite. Greg was looking at this man the way a zoologist might look at an interesting new specimen. "See anything green?" Sonny Elliman asked. Elliman topped 6 feet 5 inches. He wore an ancient, grease-stiffened jeans jacket with the arms and buttons cut off. There was no shirt beneath. A Nazi iron cross, black dressed in white chrome, hung on his bare chest. The buckle of the belt running just below his considerable beer belly was a great ivory skull. From beneath the pegged cuffs of his jeans poked the scuffed square toes of a pair of desert driver boots. His hair was shoulder length, tangled, and shining with an accumulation of greasy sweat and engine oil. From one earlobe there dangled a swastika earring, also black dressed in white chrome. He spun a coal-scuttle helmet on the tip of one blunt finger. Stitched on the back of his jacket was a leering red devil with a forked tongue. Above the devil was the Devil's Dozen. Below it, Sonny Elliman, Prez.
"No," Greg Stilson said. "I don't see anything green, but I do see someone who looks suspiciously like a walking asshole."
Elliman stiffened a little, then relaxed and laughed. In spite of the dirt, the almost palpable body odor, and Nazi regalia, his eyes, a dark green, were not without intelligence and even a sense of humor.
"Rank me to the dogs and back, man," he said. "It's been done before. You got the power now." "You recognize that, do you?" "Sure. I left my guys back in the Hamptons. Came here alone." "Be it on my own head, man," he smiled. "But if we should ever catch you in a similar position, you want to hope your kidneys are wearing combat boots."
"I'll chance it," Greg said. He measured Elliman. They were both big men. He reckoned Elliman had 40 pounds on him, but a lot of it was beer muscle.
"I could take you, Sonny."
Elliman's face crinkled in amiable good humor again.
"Maybe, maybe not. But that's not the way we play it, man. All that good American John Wayne stuff."
He leaned forward as if to impart a great secret.
"Me personally, now, whenever I get me a piece of Mom's apple pie, I make it my business to shit on it."
"Foul mouth, Sonny," Greg said mildly.
"What do you want with me?" Sonny asked. "Why don't you get down to it? You'll miss your J.C.'s meeting."
"No," Greg said, still serene. "The J.C.'s meet Tuesday nights. We've got all the time in the world." Elliman made a disgusted blowing sound. "Now what I thought," Greg went on, "is that you'd want something from me." He opened his desk drawer, and from it took 3 plastic baggies of marijuana. Mixed in with the weed were a number of gel capsules.
"Found this in your sleeping bag," Greg said. "Nasty, nasty, nasty, Sonny. Bad boy. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to New Hampshire State Prison."
"You didn't have any search warrant," Elliman said. "Even a kiddie lawyer could get me off, and you know it."
"I don't know any such thing," Greg Stilson said.
He leaned back in his swivel chair and cocked his loafers, bought across the state line at L.L. Bean's in Maine, up on his desk.
"I'm a big man in this town, Sonny. I came into New Hampshire more or less on my uppers a few years back, and now I've got a nice operation here. I've helped the town council solve a couple of problems, including just what to do about all these kids the chief of police catches doing dope. Oh, I don't mean bad hats like you, Sonny. Drifters like you we know what to do with when we catch them with a little treasure trove like that one right there on my desk. I mean the nice local kids. Nobody really wants to do anything to them at all, you know? I figured that out for them. Put them to work on community projects instead of sending them to jail, I said. It worked out real good. Now we've got the biggest head in the Tri-Town area coaching Little League and doing a real good job at it."
Elliman was looking bored. Greg suddenly brought his feet down with a crash, grabbed a vase with a UNH logo on the side, and threw it past Sonny Elliman's nose. It missed him by less than an inch, flew end over end across the room, and shattered against the file cabinets in the corner. For the first time, Elliman looked startled. And for just a moment, the face of this older, wiser Greg Stilson was the face of the younger man, the dog bludgeoner.
"You want to listen when I talk," he said softly, "because what we're discussing here is your career over the next 10 years or so. Now, if you don't have any interest in making a career out of stamping Live Free or Die on license plates, you want to listen up, Sonny. You want to pretend this is the first day of school again, Sonny. You want to get it all right the first time, Sonny."
Elliman looked at the smashed fragments of vase, then back at Stilson. His former uneasy calm was being replaced by a feeling of real interest. He hadn't been really interested in anything for quite a while now. He had made the run for beer because he was bored. He had come by himself because he was bored. And when this big guy had pulled him over, using a flashing blue light on the dashboard of his station wagon, Sonny Elliman had assumed that what he had to deal with was just another small-town deputy dog protecting his territory and rousting the big, bad biker on the modified Harley-Davidson. But this guy was something else. He was...
"He's crazy,"
Sonny realized with dawning delight at the discovery.
"He's got 2 public service awards on his wall, and pictures of him talking to the Rotarians and the Lions, and he's vice president of this dipshit town's J.C.'s, and next year he'll be president, and he's just as crazy as a fucking bedbug."
"Okay," he said, "you got my attention. I have had what you might call a checkered career," Greg told him. "I've been up, but I've also been down. I've had a few scrapes with the law. What I'm trying to say, Sonny, is that I don't have any set feelings about you. Not like the other locals. They read in the Union Leader about what you and your bikey friends are doing over in the Hamptons this summer, and they'd like to castrate you with a rusty Gillette razor blade."
"That's not the devil's dozen," Sonny said. "We came down on a run from upstate New York to get some beach time, man. We're on vacation. We're not into trashing a bunch of honky-tonk bars. There's a bunch of Hell's Angels tearing ass and a chapter of the Black Riders from New Jersey. But you know who it is mostly? A bunch of college kids."
Sonny's lip curled.
"But the papers don't like to report that, do they? They'd rather lay the rap on us than on Susie and Jim."
"You're so much more colorful," Greg said mildly. "And William Loeb over at the Union Leader doesn't like bike clubs."
"That bald-headed creep," Sonny muttered.
Greg opened his desk drawer and pulled out a flat pint of Leader's bourbon.
"I'll drink to that," he said. He cracked the seal and drank half the pint at a draught. He blew out a great breath, his eyes watering, and held the pint across the desk. "You?" Sonny polished the pint off. Warm fire bellowed up from his stomach to his throat.
"Light me up, man,"
he gasped. Greg threw back his head and laughed. "We'll get along, Sonny. I have a feeling we'll get along."
"What do you want?" Sonny asked again, holding the empty pint.
"Nothing. Not now. But I have a feeling..." Greg's eyes became far away, almost puzzled. "I told you I'm a big man in Ridgeway. I'm going to run for mayor next time the office comes up, and I'll win. But that's..."
"Just the beginning," Sonny prompted.
"It's a start, anyway." That puzzled expression was still there. "I get things done. People know it. I'm good at what I do. I feel like there's a lot ahead of me. Sky's the limit. But I'm not quite sure what I mean, you know?"
Sonny only shrugged. The puzzled expression faded.
"But there's a story, Sonny. A story about a mouse who took a thorn out of a lion's paw. He did it to repay the lion for not eating him a few years before. You know the story?"
"I might have heard it when I was a kid."
Greg nodded. "Well, it's a few years before... whatever it is, Sonny."
He shoved the plastic baggies across the desk.
"I'm not going to eat you. I could if I wanted to, you know. A kiddie lawyer couldn't get you off. In this town with the riots going on in Hampton less than 20 miles away, Clarence fucking Darrow couldn't get you off in Ridgeway. These good people would love to see you go up."
Elliman didn't reply, but he suspected Greg was right. There was nothing heavy in his dope stash. 2 brown bombers was the heaviest. But the collective parents of good old Susie and Jim would be glad to see him breaking rocks in Portsmouth with his hair cut off his head.
"I'm not going to eat you," Greg repeated. "I hope you'll remember that in a few years if I get a thorn in my paw. Or maybe if I have a job opportunity for you. Keep it in mind."
Gratitude was not in Sonny Elliman's limited catalogue of human feelings, but interest and curiosity were. He felt both ways about this man Stilson. That craziness in his eyes hinted at many things, but boredom was not one of them.
"Who knows where we'll all be in a few years," he murmured. "We could all be dead, man." "Just keep me in mind. That's all I'm asking."
Sonny looked at the broken shards of vase.
"I'll keep you in mind," he said.
1971 passed. The New Hampshire beach riots blew over, and the grumblings of the beachfront entrepreneurs were muted by the increased balances in their bank books. An obscure fellow named George McGovern declared for the presidency comically early. Anyone who followed politics knew that the nominee from the Democratic Party in 1972 was going to be Edmund Muskie, and there were those who felt he might just wrestle the troll of San Clemente off his feet and pin him to the mat. In early June, just before school let out for the summer, Sarah met the young law student again. She was in Day's appliance store, shopping for a toaster, and he had been looking for a gift for his parents' wedding anniversary. He asked her if she'd like to go to the movies with him. The new Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry, was in town. Sarah went, and the two of them had a good time. Walter Hazlitt had grown a beard, and he no longer reminded her so much of Johnny. In fact, it had become increasingly difficult for her to remember just what Johnny did look like. His face only came clear in her dreams, dreams where he stood in front of the Wheel of Fortune, watching it spin, his face cold and his blue eyes darkened to that perplexing and a little fearsome dark violet shade, watching the wheel as if it were his own private game preserve. She and Walt began to see a lot of each other. He was easy to get along with. He He made no demands, or if he did, they were of such a gradually increasing nature as to be unnoticeable. In October, he asked her if he could buy her a small diamond. Sarah asked him if she could have the weekend to think it over. That Saturday night, she had gone to the Eastern Maine Medical Center, had gotten a special red-bordered pass at the desk, and had gone up to intensive care. She sat beside Johnny's bed for an hour. Outside, the fall wind howled in the dark, promising cold, promising snow, promising a season of death. It lacked 16 days of a year since the fair, the wheel, and the head-on collision near the bog. She sat and listened to the wind and looked at Johnny. The bandages were gone. The scar began on his forehead, an inch above his right eyebrow, and twisted up under the hairline. His hair there had gone white, making her think of that fictional detective in the 87th Precinct stories. Cotton Hawes, his name was. To Sarah's eyes, there seemed to have been no degeneration in him, except for the inevitable weight loss. He was simply a young man she barely knew, fast asleep. She bent over him and kissed his mouth softly, as if the old fairy tale could be reversed and her kiss could wake him. But Johnny only slept. She left, went back to her apartment in Vizy, lay down on her bed and cried as the wind walked the dark world outside, throwing its catch of yellow and red leaves before it. On Monday, she told Walt that if he really did want to buy her a diamond, a small one, mind, she would be happy and proud to wear it. That was Sarah Bracknell's 1971. In early 1972, Edmund Muskie burst into tears during an impassioned speech outside the offices of the man Sonny Elliman had referred to as that bald-headed creep. George McGovern upset the primary, and Loeb announced gleefully in his paper that the people of New Hampshire didn't like crybabies. In July, McGovern was nominated. In that same month, Sarah Bracknell became Sarah Hazlitt. She and Walt were married in the First Methodist Church of Bangor. Less than 2 miles away, Johnny Smith slept on. And the thought of him came to Sarah, suddenly and horribly, as Walt kissed her in front of the dearly beloved there assembled for the nuptials. Johnny, she thought, and saw him as she had when the lights went on, half Jekyll and half snarling Hyde. She stiffened in Walt's arms for a moment, and then it was gone. Memory, vision, whatever it had been, it was gone. After long thought and discussion with Walt, she had invited Johnny's folks to the wedding. Herb had come along. At the reception, she asked him if Vera was all right. He glanced around, saw they were alone for the moment, and rapidly downed the remainder of his scotch and soda. He had aged 5 years in the last 18 months, she thought. His hair was thinning. The lines on his face were deeper. He was wearing glasses in the careful and self-conscious way of people who have just started wearing them, and behind the mild corrective lenses his eyes were wary and hurt. "No, she really isn't, Sarah. The truth is, she's up in Vermont, on a farm, waiting for the end of the world."
"What?"
Herb told her that 6 months ago Vera had begun to correspond with a group of about 10 people who called themselves the American Society of the Last Times. They were led by Mr. and Mrs. Harry L. Stonkers from Racine, Wisconsin. Mr. and Mrs. Stonkers claimed to have been picked up by a flying saucer while they were on a camping trip. They had been taken away to heaven, which was not out in the constellation Orion, but on an Earth-type planet that circled Arcturus. There they had communed with the Society of Angels and had seen paradise. The Stonkerses had been informed that the last times were at hand. They were given the power of telepathy and had been sent back to Earth to gather a few faithful together, for the first shuttle to heaven, as it were. And so the 10 of them had gotten together, bought a farm north of St. Johnsbury, and had been settled in there for about 7 weeks, waiting for the saucer to come and pick them up.
"It sounds," Sarah began, and then closed her mouth.
"I know how it sounds," Herb said. "It sounds crazy. The place cost them $9,000. It's nothing but a crashed-in farmhouse with 2 acres of scrubland. Vera's share was $700, all she could put up. There was no way I could stop her, short of committal. He paused, then smiled. But this is nothing to talk about at your wedding party, Sarah. You and your feller are going to have all the best. I know you will.
Sarah smiled back as best she could. Thank you, Herb. Will you... I mean, do you think she'll...
come back? Oh, yes. If the world doesn't end by winter, I think she'll be back.
Oh, I only wish you the best, she said, and embraced him.
The farm in Vermont had no furnace, and when the saucer had still not arrived by late October, Vera came home. The saucer had not come, she said, because they were not yet perfect. They had not burned away the non-essential and sinful dross of their lives. But she was uplifted and spiritually exalted. She had had a sign in a dream. She was perhaps not meant to go to heaven in a saucer. She felt more and more strongly that she would be needed to guide her boy, show him the proper way when he came out of his trance. Herb took her in, loved her as best he could, and life went on. Johnny had been in his coma for 2 years. Nixon was reinaugurated. The American boys started coming home from Vietnam. Walter Hazlitt took his bar exam and was invited to take it again at a later date. Sarah Hazlitt kept school while he crammed for his tests. The students who had been silly, gawky freshmen the year she started teaching were now juniors. Flat-chested girls had become bosomy. Shrimps who hadn't been able to find their way around the building were now playing varsity basketball. The second Arab-Israeli war came and went. The oil boycott came and went. Bruisingly high gasoline prices came and did not go. Vera Smith became convinced that Christ would return from below the earth at the South Pole. This intelligence was based on a new pamphlet, 17 pages, price $4.50, entitled God's Tropical Underground. The startling hypothesis of the pamphleteer was that heaven was actually below our very feet, and that the easiest point of ingress was the South Pole. One of the sections of the pamphlet was Psychic Experiences of the South Pole Explorers. Herb pointed out to her that less than a year before, she had been convinced that heaven was somewhere out there, most probably circling Arcturus. "I'd surely be more apt to believe that than this crazy South Pole stuff," he told her. "After all, the Bible says heaven's in the sky. That tropical place below the ground is supposed to be..."
"Stop it," she said sharply, lips pressed into white lines. "No need to mock what you don't understand."
"I wasn't mocking, Vera," he said quietly.
"God knows why the unbeliever mocks and the heathen rages," she said.
That blank light was in her eyes. They were sitting at the kitchen table, Herb with an old plumbing J-bolt in front of him, Vera with a stack of old National Geographics, which she had been gleaning for South Pole pictures and stories. Outside, restless clouds fled west to east, and the leaves showered off the trees. It was early October again, and October always seemed to be her worst month. It was the month when that blank light came more frequently to her eyes and stayed longer. And it was always in October that his thoughts turned treacherously to leaving them both, his possibly certifiable wife and his sleeping son, who was probably already dead by any practical definition. Just now, he had been turning the J-bolt over in his hands and looking out of the window at the restless sky and thinking, "I could pack up. Just throw my things into the back of the pickup and go. Florida, maybe. Nebraska. California. A good carpenter can make good money any damn place. Just get up and go." But he knew he wouldn't. It was just that October was his month to think about running away, as it seemed to be Vera's month to discover some new pipeline to Jesus and the eventual salvation of the only child she had been able to nurture in her substandard womb. Now he reached across the table and took her hand, which was thin and terribly bony, an old woman's hand. She looked up, surprised. I love you very much, Vera, he said. She smiled back, and for a glimmering moment she was a great deal like the girl he had courted and won, the girl who had goosed him with a hairbrush on their wedding night. It was a gentle smile, her eyes briefly clear and warm and loving in return. Outside, the sun came out from behind a fat cloud, dived behind another one, and came out again, sending great shudder shadows fleeing across their back field.
I know you do, Herbert, and I love you.
He put his other hand over hers and clasped it. Vera, he said.
Yes?
Her eyes were so clear. Suddenly she was with him, totally with him, and it made him realize how dreadfully far apart they had grown over the last 3 years.
Vera, if he never does wake up, God forbid, but if he doesn't, we'll still have each other, won't we? I mean, she jerked her hand away. His two hands, which had been holding it lightly, clapped on nothing.
Don't you ever say that. Don't you ever say that Johnny isn't going to wake up.
All I meant was that we...
Of course he's going to wake up,
she said, looking out the window to the field where the shadows still crossed and crossed.
It's God's plan for him. Oh, yes. Don't you think I know? I know, believe me. God has great things in store for my Johnny. I have heard him in my heart.
Yes, Vera, he said.
Okay.
Her fingers groped for the National Geographics, found them, and began to turn the pages again.
I know,
she said in a childish, petulant voice.
Okay, he said quietly.
She looked at her magazines. Herb propped his chin in his palms and looked out at the sunshine and shadow and thought how soon winter came after golden, treacherous October. He wished Johnny would die. He had loved the boy from the very first. He had seen the wonder on his tiny face when Herb had brought a tiny tree frog to the boy's carriage and had put the small living thing in the boy's hands. He had taught Johnny how to fish and skate and shoot. He had sat up with him all night during his terrible bout with the flu in 1951, when the boy's temperature had crested at a giddy 105 degrees. He had hidden tears in his hand when Johnny graduated salutatorian of his high school class and had made his speech from memory without a slip. So many memories of him, teaching him to drive, standing on the bow of the Bolero with him when they went to Nova Scotia on vacation 1 year. Johnny, 8 years old, laughing and excited by the screw-like motion of the boat, helping him with his homework, helping him with his treehouse, helping him get the hang of his silver compass when he had been in the scouts. All the memories were jumbled together in no chronological order at all. Johnny was the single unifying thread. Johnny eagerly discovering the world that had maimed him so badly in the end. And now he wished Johnny would die. Oh, how he wished it, that he would die, that his heart would stop beating, that the final low traces on the EEG would go flat, that he would just flicker out like a guttering candle in a pool of wax, that he would die and release them. The seller of lightning rods arrived at Kathy's Roadhouse in Somersworth, New Hampshire, in the early afternoon of a blazing summer's day, less than a week after the 4th of July in that year of 1973. And somewhere, not so far away, there were, perhaps, storms only waiting to be born in the warm elevator shafts of summer's thermal updrafts. He was a man with a big thirst, and he stopped at Kathy's to slake it with a couple of beers, not to make a sale. But from force of long habit, he glanced up at the roof of the low ranch-style building, and the unbroken line he saw standing against the blistering gunmetal sky caused him to reach back in for the scuffled suede bag that was his sample case. Inside, Kathy's was dark and cool and silent, except for the muted rumble of the color TV on the wall. A few regulars were there, and behind the bar was the owner, keeping an eye on As the World Turns, along with his patrons. The seller of lightning rods lowered himself onto a bar stool and put his sample case on the stool to his left. The owner came over.
Hi, friend. What'll it be?
A bud, the lightning rod salesman said. And draw another for yourself if you're of a mind.
I'm always of a mind, the owner said.
He returned with two beers, took the salesman's dollar, and left three dimes on the bar.
Bruce Carrick, he said, and offered his hand.
The seller of lightning rods shook it.
Dahi is the name, he said. Andrew Dahi.
He drained off half his beer.
Pleased to meet you, Carrick said.
He wandered off to serve a young woman with a hard face, another tequila sunrise, and eventually wandered back to Dahi.
From out of town?
I am, Dahi admitted.
Salesman.
He glanced around.
Is it always this quiet?
No, it jumps on the weekends, and I do a fair trade through the week. Private parties is where we make our dough, if we make it.
I ain't starving, but neither am I driving a Cadillac.
He pointed a pistol finger at Dahi's glass.
Freshen that? And another for yourself, Mr. Carrick.
Bruce, he laughed.
You must want to sell me something.
When Carrick returned with the beers, the seller of lightning rods said,
I came in to lay the dust, not sell anything. But now that you mention it...
He hauled his sample case up onto the bar with a practiced jerk. Things jingled inside it.
Oh, here it comes, Carrick said and laughed.
Two of the afternoon regulars, an old fellow with a wart on his right eyelid, and a younger man in gray fatigues, wandered over to see what Dahi was selling. The hard-faced woman went on watching As the World Turns. Dahi took out three rods, a long one with a brass ball at the tip, a shorter one, and one with porcelain conductors.
What the hell? Carrick said.
Lightning rods, the old campaigner said and cackled. He wants to save this gin mill from God's wrath, Brucey. You better listen to what he says.
He laughed again. The man in the gray fatigues joined him. Carrick's face darkened, and the lightning rod salesman knew that whatever chance he had had of making a sale had just flown away. He was a good salesman, good enough to recognize that this queer combination of personalities and circumstances sometimes got together and queered any chance of a deal even before he had a chance to swing into his pitch. He took it philosophically and went into his spiel anyway, mostly from force of habit.
As I was getting out of my car, I just happened to notice that this fine establishment wasn't equipped with lightning conductors, and that it's constructed of wood. Now, for a very small price and easy credit terms, if you should want them, I can guarantee that lightning will strike this place at 4 this afternoon,
the man in the gray fatigue said with a grin. The old campaigner cackled.
Mr. No offense, Carrick said, but you see that...
He pointed to a golden nail on a small wooden plaque beside the TV near the glistening array of bottles. Spiked on the nail was a drift of papers.
All of those things are bills. They got to be paid by the 15th of the month. They get written in red ink. Now you see how many people are in here drinking right now? I got to be careful.
Just my point, Dahi broke in smoothly. You have to be careful. And the purchase of 3 or 4 lightning rods is a careful purchase. You've got a going concern here. You wouldn't want it wiped out by one stroke of lightning on a summer's day, would you?
He wouldn't mind, the old campaigner said. He'd just collect the insurance and go down to Florida, wouldn't you, Brucey?
Carrick looked at the old man with distaste.
Well, then, let's talk about insurance, the lightning rod salesman interposed.
The man in the gray fatigues had lost interest and had wandered away.
Your fire insurance premiums will go down?
The insurance is all lumped together, Carrick said flatly. Look, I just can't afford the outlay. Sorry. Now, if you was to talk to me again next year...
Well, perhaps I will, the lightning rod salesman said, giving up. Perhaps I will.
No one thought they could be struck by lightning until they were struck. It was a constant fact of this business. You couldn't make a fellow like this Carrick see that it was the cheapest form of fire insurance he could buy. But Dahi was a philosopher. After all, he had told the truth when he said he came in to lay the dust. To prove it, and to prove there were no hard feelings, he ordered another beer. But this time he did not match it with one for Carrick. The old campaigner slid onto the stool beside him.
"About 10 years ago, there was a fella got hit by lightning out on the golf course," he said. "Killed him just as dead as shit. Now, there's a man could have used a lightning rod right up on his head, am I right?"
He cackled, sending out a lot of stale beer breath into Dahi's face. Dahi smiled dutifully.
"All the coins in his pockets were fused together. That's what I heard. Lightning's a funny thing. Sure is. Now, I remember one time..."
A funny thing, Dahi thought, letting the old man's words flow harmlessly over him, nodding in the right places out of instinct. A funny thing, all right, because it doesn't care who or what it hits, or when. He finished his beer and went out, carrying his satchel full of insurance against the wrath of God, maybe the only kind ever invented, with him. The heat struck him like a hammer blow. But still he paused for a moment in the mostly deserted parking lot, looking up at the unbroken line of roof ridge. 1995, 2995 tops, and the man couldn't afford the outlay. He'd save $70 on his combined insurance the first year, but he couldn't afford the outlay. And you couldn't tell him different with those clowns standing around yucking it up. Maybe someday he would be sorry. The seller of lightning rods got into his Buick, cranked up the air conditioning, and drove away west toward Concord and Berlin, his sample case on the seat beside him, running ahead of whatever storms might be whistling up the wind behind. In early 1974, Walt Hazlitt passed his bar exams. He and Sarah threw a party for all of his friends, her friends, and their mutual friends, more than 40 people in all. The beer flowed like water, and after it was over, Walt said they could count themselves damn lucky not to have been evicted. When the last of the guests were seen out, at 3 a.m, Walt had come back from the door to find Sarah in the bedroom, naked except for her shoes and the diamond clip earrings he had gone into hock to give her for her birthday. They had made love not once but twice before falling into sodden slumber, from which they awoke at nearly noon with paralyzing hangovers. About 6 weeks later, Sarah discovered that she was pregnant. Neither of them ever doubted that conception had occurred on the night of the big party. In Washington, Richard Nixon was being pressed slowly into a corner, wrapped in a snarl of magnetic tapes. In Georgia, a peanut farmer, ex-Navy man, and current governor named James Earl Carter had begun talking with a number of close friends about running for the job Mr. Nixon would soon be vacating. In room 619 of the Eastern Maine Medical Center, Johnny Smith still slept. He had begun to pull into a fetal shape. Dr. Strawns, the doctor who had talked to Herb and Vera and Sarah in the conference room on the day following the accident, had died of burns in late 1973. His house had caught fire on the day after Christmas. The Bangor Fire Department had determined that the fire had been caused by a faulty set of Christmas tree ornaments. Two new doctors, Weitzak and Brown, interested themselves in Johnny's case. 4 days before Nixon resigned, Herb Smith fell into the foundation of a house he was building in Gray, landed on a wheelbarrow, and broke his leg. The bone was a long time healing, and it never really felt good again. He limped, and on wet days he began to use a cane. Vera prayed for him, and insisted that he wrap a cloth that had been personally blessed by the Reverend Freddie Coltsmore of Bessemer, Alabama, around the leg each night when he went to bed. The price of the blessed Coltsmore cloth, as Herb called it, was $35. It did no good that he was aware of. In the middle of October, shortly after Gerald Ford had pardoned the ex-president, Vera became sure that the world was going to end again. Herb realized what she was about barely in time. She had made arrangements to give what little cash and savings they had recouped since Johnny's accident to the Last Time Society of America. She had tried to put the house up for sale and had made an arrangement with the Goodwill, which was going to send a van out in 2 days' time to pick up all the furniture. Herb found out when the realtor called him to ask if a prospective buyer could come and look at the house that afternoon. For the first time, he had genuinely lost his temper with Vera.
"What in Christ's name did you think you were doing?" he roared after dragging the last of the incredible story out of her. They were in the living room. He had just finished calling Goodwill to tell them to forget the van. Outside, rain fell in monotonous gray sheets.
"Don't blaspheme the name of the Savior, Herbert. Don't—"
"Shut up! Shut up! I am tired of listening to you rave about that crap!" She drew in a startled gasp. He limped over to her, his cane thumping the floor in counterpoint. She flinched back a little in her chair, and then looked up at him with that sweet martyr's expression that made him want God forgive him to bust her one across the head with his own damn walking stick. "You're not so far gone that you don't know what you're doing," he said. "You don't have that excuse. You snuck around behind my back, Vera. You—"
"I did not. That's a lie. I did no such—"
"You did," he bellowed. "Well, you listen to me, Vera. This is where I'm drawing the line. You pray all you want. Praying's free. Write all the letters you want. A stamp still only costs 13 cents. If you want to take a bath in all the cheap, shitty lies those Jesus jumpers tell, if you want to go on with the delusions and the make-believe, you go on. But I'm not a part of it. Remember that. Do you understand me?
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Do you understand me?
You think I'm crazy!"
she shouted at him, and her face crumpled and squeezed together in a terrible way. She burst into the braying, ugly tears of utter defeat and disillusion. "No," he said more quietly, "not yet. But maybe it's time for a little plain talk, Vera. And the truth is, I think you will be if you don't pull out of this and start facing reality."
"You'll see,"
she said through her tears.
"You'll see. God knows the truth, but waits."
"Just as long as you understand that he's not going to have our furniture while he's waiting," Herb said grimly. "As long as we see eye to eye on that."
"It's last times," she told him. "The hour of the apocalypse is at hand."
"Yeah? That and 15 cents will buy you a cup of coffee, Vera." Outside, the rain fell in steady sheets. That was the year Herb turned 52, Vera 51, and Sarah Hazlitt 27. Johnny had been in his coma for 4 years. The baby came on a Halloween night. Sarah's labor lasted 9 hours. She was given mild whiffs of gas when she needed them, and at some point in her extremity, it occurred to her that she was in the same hospital as Johnny, and she called his name over and over again. Afterwards, she barely remembered this, and certainly never told Walt. She thought she might have dreamed it. The baby was a boy. They named him Dennis Edward Hazlitt. He and his mother went home 3 days later, and Sarah was teaching again after the Thanksgiving holiday. Walt had landed what looked like a fine job with a Bangor firm of lawyers, and if all went well, they planned for Sarah to quit teaching in June of 1975. She wasn't all that sure she wanted to. She had grown to like it. On the first day of 1975, two small boys, Charlie Norton and Norm Lawson, both of Otisfield, Maine, were in the Norton's backyard having a snowball fight. Charlie was 8, Norm was 9. The day was overcast and drippy. Sensing the end of the snowball fight was nearing, it was almost time for lunch, Norm charged Charlie, throwing a barrage of snowballs. Ducking and laughing, Charlie was at first forced back, and then turned tail and ran, jumping the low stone wall that divided the Norton backyard from the woods. He ran down the path that led toward Strimmer's Brook. As he went, Norm caught him a damn good one on the back of the hood. Then Charlie disappeared from sight. Norm jumped the wall and stood there for a moment, looking into the snowy woods and listening to the drip of meltwater from the birches, pines, and spruces.
"Come on back, chicken!"
Norm called, and made a series of high, gobbling sounds. Charlie didn't rise to the bait. There was no sign of him now, but the path descended steeply as it went down toward the brook. Norm gobbled again, and shifted irresolutely from one foot to the other. These were Charlie's woods, not his. Charlie's territory. Norm loved a good snowball fight when he was winning, but he didn't really want to go down there if Charlie was lying in ambush for him with half a dozen good hard slush balls all ready to go.
Nonetheless, he had taken half a dozen steps down the path when a high, breathless scream rose from below. Norm Lawson went as cold as the snow his green gum-rubber boots were planted in. The two snowballs he had been holding dropped from his hands and plopped to the ground. The scream rose again, so thin it was barely audible.
Jeepers creepers, he went and fell in the brook, Norm thought, and that broke the paralysis of his fear.
He ran down the path, slipping and sliding, falling right on his can once. His heartbeat roared in his ears. Part of his mind saw him fishing Charlie from the brook just before he went down for the third time and getting written up in boy's life as a hero. 3/4 of the way down the slope, the path dog-legged, and when he got round the corner, he saw that Charlie Norton hadn't fallen in Strimmer's brook after all. He was standing at the place where the path leveled out, and he was staring at something in the melting snow. His hood had fallen back, and his face was nearly as white as the snow itself. As Norm approached, he uttered that horrible, gasping, out-of-breath scream again.
"What is it?"
Norm asked, approaching.
"Charlie, what's wrong?"
Charlie turned to him, his eyes huge, his mouth gaping. He tried to speak, but nothing came out of his mouth but two inarticulate grunts and a silver cord of saliva. He pointed ahead. Norm came closer and looked. Suddenly, all the strength went out of his legs, and he sat down hard. The world swam around him. Protruding from the melting snow were two legs clad in blue jeans. There was a loafer on one foot, but the other was bare, white, and defenseless. One arm stuck out of the snow, and the hand at the end of it seemed to plead for a rescue that had never come. The rest of the body was still mercifully hidden. Charlie and Norm had discovered the body of 17-year-old Carol Dunbarger, the fourth victim of the Castle Rock Strangler. It had been almost 2 years since he had last killed, and the people of Castle Rock, Strimmer's Brook formed the southern borderline between the towns of Castle Rock and Otisfield, had begun to relax, thinking the nightmare was finally over. It wasn't.